Our scripture lesson this morning will be taken from John chapter 15, beginning at verse 9 and going through 15. As the Father loved me, I also loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friend. You are my friend if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I call you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you.
Good morning, everyone. We have a pretty good group present this morning, and we're glad you're here. And as was announced earlier, we have visitors, and we're especially thankful for your being here. We want you to come back at every opportunity that you have to be together with us. As you can tell from the title of the lesson, and you could gather from the theme of the songs that James chose, very appropriate songs, I'm going to talk about gifts this morning, practical gifts, and we'll get into that in just a moment, but a couple announcements I want to make before we begin. First of all, if you notice in the bulletin, there's an announcement on the front page of the bulletin. Wes Gossett, who's out of town this week, of course, but will be back next week, or this week, I guess, he will be back, and next Sunday he will be back, would like to meet with everyone next Sunday, Sunday morning following services. And it's Father's Day, and know that, but it won't be that long of a meeting. But if you're interested in doing personal evangelism, getting involved in some things, that some ideas and so forth, stay around a few minutes, and I'm sure that'll be a very profitable meeting. But, you know, it won't take that long, but it'll be very, very profitable to you. Secondly, I want to make mention, I was talking with Frank and Agatha a little bit last night, and Agatha asked that, Agatha Thomas, of course, asked that mention her family and that you be mindful of them, keep them in your prayers. They're going through some struggles and personal situations there, with especially involving little Gio. And if you just keep them in your prayers, that God will be with them, and those that our professionals that are helping out with all of that and so forth, they surely would appreciate it as they go through this difficult time. So bear them in mind, if you will. Without any further delay, let's get into the lesson. We're reminded in James chapter 1 and verse 17 that every good gift and every perfect gift comes down from above, from the Father of lights, as James says. I want to talk a little bit this morning about gifts. And let me begin. I'd like for you to reflect, if you will, on a question. What's the best gift you've ever been given? I'd just like for you to think about that. And for those of you that are older, the older you are, the further back in time you'll have to think about it. You might reflect upon a time as a child when you got a particular gift. Or it might be another time in your life. But what's the best gift that anyone ever gave you? I'd like for you to ponder that for a moment, as we take a look at a little story to start the lesson. And this is the story of Mama's Bible. There were four brothers that left home for college, and they became successful doctors and lawyers, and they prospered. Some years later, they got together and chatted after having dinner together. They discussed the gifts that they were able to give their elderly mother, who lived far away in another city. The first said, "I had a big house built for Mama." The second said, "I had my Mercedes dealer deliver an SL 600 to her, top of the line Mercedes." The third said, I had a $100,000 theater built in Mama's house. Can you imagine? The fourth one said, well, you know how Mama loved reading the Bible, and you know she can't read anymore because she can't see very well. Now, this is amazing here. I met this preacher who told me about a parrot that can recite the entire Bible. Can you imagine? He said it took 20 preachers 12 years to teach this parrot. And I had to pledge to contribute $100,000 a year for 20 years to the church, but it was worth it. Because all Mama has to do is name the chapter and verse, and the parrot will recite it. Amazing. The other brothers were naturally impressed. And later, their mom sent out her thank you notes to them. And she wrote, to the first, Milton, the house you built is so huge, I live in only one room, but I have to clean the whole house. Still, I thank you, son. Marvin, I'm too old to travel. I stay home and I have my groceries delivered, so I never use the Mercedes. But the thought was good. Thank you. Matthew, you gave me an expensive theater with Dolby Sound that can hold 50 people. But all my friends are dead. I've lost my hearing, son, and I'm nearly blind. I'll never use it. But thank you for the gesture just the same. To the fourth son, she wrote this. Dearest Melvin, you were the only son to have the good sense to give a little thought to your gift. The chicken was delicious. Thank you. Love, Mama. Practical gifts. When I read that story, I tell you what, I have laughed about that more and more and more. So I had to share it with you. Not mine originally, but you may or may not have seen that. But I got to thinking as I looked at this story about the whole idea of gifts and gifts that are practical and so forth. And so I want to spend some time this morning talking about not only the best of gifts or the greatest of gifts, but practical gifts. Each son in this story, as funny as it is, each son in this story was trying to give his mother the greatest gift that he could buy. They were all successful. They all had money. But unfortunately, none of them really thought very much about how practical the gift was, the chicken notwithstanding. Not, you know, how practical a gift he was giving his mother. He bought her an expensive gift. He bought her a great gift in the eyes of people, but it wasn't very practical. It leads us, it leads us to think about the greatest and most practical gifts that we can give our loved ones, and I want to suggest to you three this morning that we can give. One of the most practical but greatest gifts that a parent can give a child is to raise him with the knowledge of God. We were looking at this in our class on Friday night. This kind of coincided with this lesson. But we were talking about the idea of raising a child in the knowledge of God. And some of the things that we thought about were this. You know, one of the simplest things you can do as a parent is to bring a child to Bible study, Sunday school if you want to call it that, and Bible study on Wednesday night, and to church. And you'll notice what I say here regularly. Children are amazing. And one of the things that they do, and our lesson bore this out, it said many lessons are caught, that's with a C, rather than taught. And the idea was children will not only listen, of course, to their parents, and, you know, the parent can reinforce that, and especially as the child is young, they don't want a spanking or whatever. But more importantly, maybe far more importantly, children are going to catch lessons. They're going to watch their parents and they're going to emulate many things their parents do. If we as parents make it a priority to be at church, that's a priority. To be at Sunday school, to be at Bible study, to be there on time, to, you know, be excited about it, etc., involved in it, our children catch that lesson. We need to make it a priority to be here. We don't need to look at it and teach our children or convey the idea to children that it's an afterthought, that it's something if we have time, we'll squeeze it in. if something else doesn't get in the way or whatever, but rather that this is the priority of our lives. There's nothing more important that we do, as Ed talked about a moment ago with the Lord's Supper. It's something that they see. It's something that they can watch. It's something we do to remind ourselves of what the Lord has done for us. That's one of the greatest gifts we can give to our children as they're growing up from a young age, even from a younger age than they really understand it. For a child to grow up being able to think in these terms, there never has been a time in my life when I wasn't going to church. Now, I've heard people say that. I couldn't say that, unfortunately. But I've heard many people say that. You know, I don't ever remember a time when I wasn't going to church, because obviously from the very beginning, a couple of weeks after they were born, their parents were taking them to church. And they just grew up with that. It's very important. And it's one of the most practical but greatest gifts a parent can give a child. You know, to teach him daily. I'd like for you to turn back with me, if you will, to the book of Deuteronomy. And you'll notice here that God was instructing the people as they were entering, or about to enter in this case, in Deuteronomy 6, about to enter the land of Canaan. And if you'll begin reading with me in verse 4, this was considered by the Jews to be the Shema, the crux of the law of God, the covenant with God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. Remember, Jesus quoted that. And these words that I command you this day shall be in your heart. And you shall teach them diligently, verse 7, to your children. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk in the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You think about the idea of raising children in the knowledge of God. That this is something you do every Sunday, but not just every Sunday. This is something you do on a daily basis. You're studying with them. I know some of you, for example, you talk about the fact that when you were little kids, your mother might gather you around the kitchen table or around, you know, the living room floor or whatever it might be, and have studies with you, talks with you, talk to you about the Bible. Now, that's something I can remember as a child from a very young age. I've got a vivid memory right now of my grandmother, of my mother, of sitting on the couch with my mother in a little Bible story book. And I enjoyed that. I mean, it was a favorite time of mine to listen to those stories and so forth. Being raised in the knowledge of God is something that stays with you all your life. You'll notice here that he goes on in verse 8, and something Ed was saying a moment ago during the address before the Lord's Supper, talking about symbols and using that idea from Numbers 15 of the tassels on the clothing. Well, here he says, you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets, our symbols. Some translators interpret the word to mean between your eyes. You'll write them upon the post of your house and on your gates. You know, children growing up with reminders, you know, some mothers stick things on refrigerators or have different pictures, maybe a picture on the wall with a Bible verse under it, and maybe in each room of the house. It's the idea of growing up knowing that God is important in our lives. It's one of the most practical, it's one of the simplest, but one of the most practical and yet greatest gifts you can give to a child, to raise them in the knowledge of God. Obviously, Proverbs 22 and verse 6 says, train up a child in the way he should go. When he is old, he'll not depart from it. Now, obviously, that's not an absolute. Most things in the book of Proverbs are not absolutes. It doesn't mean that we won't have a free will when we're grown to choose to depart from God and depart from the knowledge of God that our parents raised us in. We can choose that. We are free to choose. But it does mean, and I think James said it this way on Friday night, the best odds. In other words, if you want your children to be right, if you want them to be good, moral, if you want them to be Christians, the best odds you have of that are the things you do when they're children. And many times the things they do when they're little children. And it may seem like it's a chore or a task or whatever to get up every single Sunday morning and get them ready and get them to church. But it's so important. And it means so much later. And perhaps it will save them so much heartache later. What a great gift that is to give to a child. You think about a number of passages in the Bible, such as Ephesians chapter 6. And in verse 4 there, as it says, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but raise them up in the nurture and the admonition. The idea is training and instruction and even warning that God gives. I want you to look with me at a couple of passages very briefly in Timothy, in 2 Timothy, and then I'll turn away from this point. But notice as Paul said to Timothy, we remember that Timothy was a companion of Paul, and a very powerful companion, someone that Paul trusted. And even that Paul would say about Timothy that he is naturally disposed toward the goodness and toward Christianity. And he said he had no one like-minded to Timothy. Well, where did all of that come from? Well, Paul tells him, reminds him, if you will, in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5, when I call to remembrance the unfeigned, notice, non-hypocritical is the idea, the unfeigned faith that is in thee, that was that dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I'm persuaded that it's in you also. Turn a page or so to chapter 3 and notice something else Paul says here. Drop down to verse 14. When he says to Timothy, continue thou in the things, and we think about this point here, continue thou in the things which thou hast learned and been assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them. Now, if you just read that verse, you might assume that Paul means himself, but he doesn't. Knowing of whom thou hast learned them, verse 15, and that from a child, literally in the original, the word here is that from a little child, or an infant even, that from an infant or infancy, you have known the holy scriptures that are able to make you wise unto salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. When Paul met Timothy, he must have been somewhere in the range of maybe 14 to 18 years old. We don't know exactly. But when he met a young man who had been raised in the knowledge of God. He met a young man whose mother and grandmother had taught him about God regularly, daily. Had taught him about God. No doubt that they saw to it that he was trained in the scriptures, that he learned them, that he knew who God was and what God was all about. And no doubt it is that faith that they taught him and instilled in him, for Paul is saying that, that led to Timothy being that great Christian and that great companion and fellow worker of Paul. So vital. One of the most practical but yet greatest gifts you can give as a parent to a child. Let's suggest something else, though. Another most practical but greatest of gifts is to be a true friend or a real friend. I'll use those phrases interchangeably because people do. A true friend, a real friend. We all want friends. And I'm sure if we went around the room today, we all would say we have friends. We have real friends, true friends. Probably most of us would use the language best friends. I suppose if you're texting and so forth today, what is it, BFF or BFFL or whatever it is? But we all have those friends. We all have those people we're so close to. But are we true friends, real friends? I'd like for us to think about that for a moment. What's the common view of a real friend or a true friend? Who do we consider to be a friend? We could ask a series of questions like this. We could say, is my real friend or someone I consider a friend somebody that approves of everything I do? Now, I know that I like for people to approve of what I do. I don't like for people to disapprove of what I do. I like to think I'm right, and I want to be considered to be right, etc. But I also know that the truth is I'm often wrong. So is it someone that approves of everything I do? Is it someone that'll tell me I'm right about everything, regardless of if I really am? I mean, who is a real friend? The guy that's flattering you or the person that's flattering you and building you up and patting you on the back and telling you everything's wonderful about yourself? Is it someone who flatters you and builds your ego? Is that a person that we consider a real friend? I would venture to say that there are certain people in life that only want people who will be, and the term today, the euphemism for it is, positive. Only want someone to be positive. I only want someone who will tell me, yes, everything you do is fine with me. You know, I approve of anything you do. Whatever you want to do, that's great, that's fine. There are even parents out there who will do that toward their children. Whatever you want to do is fine with me. And never object to anything. And the person that will tell you you're right, the person that builds your ego, is that a real friend? Is that a true friend? I want to suggest to you, and I believe this, the person that does, that's the worst enemy you'll ever have. I mean, a person that does that is doing nothing but helping you, first of all, to be less than you can be. Secondly, to be wrong in the sight of God, for many times we are, and if the person is approving of it, it reinforces me to be wrong. That person is the worst enemy I could ever have. So let's suggest a practical and great gift we can be is to be a true friend. Now, a true friend will always be there. And we say that sometimes, well, what does that mean again? Well, it means in the worst of times, it means in the hardest of times, this person won't abandon you. It means that you could call them in the middle of the night, so to speak, and say, I need your help, and they will be there. It means that when you're wrong, they will be there. It means when you're less than you're supposed to be, they will be there. Not to tell you you're okay, not to approve of it, but to stand by you and to help you through that time. I want to suggest some passages to you. And the fact that a true friend will encourage you in all that's right, they'll always do that, but they'll rebuke you when you're wrong. And that's being a real friend or a true friend. In other words, if you have someone you consider to be a best friend, if you had them for some time and they've never once told you you're wrong about anything, that's just not a friend. A real friend is someone that will rebuke you and will tell you where you're wrong and you need to change. Notice how the Bible puts it. Go with me to the book of Proverbs and let's read a half dozen passages, not spending really any long amount of time on them because they're very self-explanatory. But look at Proverbs 17 and verse 17. When it says this, a friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. A friend will love you at all times. He'll always be there. Turn a page or so over to chapter 18 and look at verse 24. A man that has friends must show himself friendly. The idea of if you want a friend, be a friend is the idea. But you'll notice also something that Solomon said, and there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. When you become best of friends and the older you get and the more you mature, and we teach young people this, I think, at least I do. Because the older you get, the more you mature, the more you realize that everybody out there won't be your friend. And they certainly won't be what the real definition of a friend is, such as this passage. But that there will be those people. And when you have those people that stick closer than a brother and so forth, treasure them. Love them. Consider that a valuable gift that you've been given by God. There is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. Now, having said that, let's consider a couple of other passages. Look at chapter 27 and start with me in verse 5. What is the definition of a real friend? Well, you'll notice here that he begins to say things like this. Open rebuke is better than hidden or secret love. What is a real friend? Somebody that will openly rebuke you. They can and they will. Notice verse 6, that outside of this context would be hard to understand. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Now again, that wouldn't make sense. I mean, we might think in terms of friends don't hurt you. They don't wound you. Well, sometimes you need to be hurt. Sometimes you need to be wounded. Sometimes you need to be rebuked, for example. Or you need to be scolded or whatever it might be. You need somebody to tell you the truth. You need them to tell you like it is, not like you'd like to hear it. And so faithful are the wounds of a friend. Now, on the other hand, notice the kisses of an enemy. That's all that flattery and everything we were talking about a moment ago. They're deceitful. The kisses of an enemy are deceitful. You think about Judas, maybe the classic picture, coming out and kissing Jesus, perhaps on the cheek, and calling him friend. And Jesus looking him square in the face and saying, you call me friend? You kiss me on the cheek and you stab me in the back. That's the worst kind of enemy you can have. You notice the passage goes on to say here in verse 7, the full soul loathes a honeycomb. I think the idea here is when you're full, and you know how you feel when you've eaten and you're full and you don't think you can eat anything else. And maybe somebody sets some decadent dessert in front of you and it just makes you sick, the thought of it. Because the idea is you don't want any more. And I believe the idea in this passage is the full soul, the one that's complete, the one that is mature, etc., He loathes all that flattery that the world wants to give. All that pleasantry and all of that kind of thing that you can get from anybody. And what he wants is a real friend that will help him to be better. The full soul loathes a honeycomb, but to the hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet. As a bird that wanders from her nest, so is a man that wanders from his place. Ointment and perfume rejoice the heart, so does the sweetness of a man's friend. Notice, by hearty counsel. It may not sound good at the time, and it may not feel good at the time, for a friend to tell you what you need to do and how to be better. But in the long run, it's the best. It's the nourishment. It's what you need, and you're better. Notice verse 10. Your own friend and your father's friend forsake not, and neither go into your brother's house in the day of calamity. This is the idea of running for safety to your brother's house. Better is a neighbor that is near than a brother far off. Drop down, if you will, to verse 17. And notice how he says here, iron sharpens iron. If you've ever watched someone sharpen an iron instrument, you know, there's a lot of sparks. You know, there's a lot of friction is the idea. And that's what it takes to put a sharp edge on a blade. Well, if you think about it, the picture here is sometimes it takes some friction between friends. But you're getting better. You're getting sharper for it. Iron sharpens iron. So a man sharpens the countenance, the overall appearance and attitude and so forth of his friend. Look at verse 19. As in water, face answers to face, so the heart of man to man. It is said, and I believe it is so, you can define an individual by his friends. That doesn't mean we're not all individuals and we're not all individual before God. But it does mean if you want to know who I am, that you can look at me and you can also look at my friends, those I consider the closest to me. And that will basically tell you what I am. If I've surrounded myself with people that are of little value, people that are worldly, like the passages are talking about, the flattery and the kisses of an enemy and all of that, then you can pretty much tell what's in my heart. But if I consider my closest friends to be those who at times will pull me aside and say, look, you know, this is what you're doing and this is what needs to change, then you can tell that that's also in my heart. I want to be better. I want to be right before God. I think of a passage, my favorite, probably in all the Old Testament. I've read it and quoted it before. But if you look at Malachi chapter 3 and verses 16 through 18, and you listen to what it says there, those that fear the Lord speak often to each other. And a book of remembrance is written before God. And he takes notice of them is the idea. God acknowledges the friendship that exists between them. And in the day in the future when God makes up, gathers his jewels, and I believe he speaks of judgment day, they'll be there. And they'll be there as much as anything for those times that they cared enough to speak to each other, to talk to each other, to share with each other. Not just, hey, baby, you're doing everything great, you know. But here's what you need to change. And they confess faults to each other. And they pray for each other. And they help each other. That's being a real friend. It's one of the most practical but greatest gifts that you can give is to be a real friend. Let me suggest something finally to you. That the greatest and most practical gift you can give someone you love and who loves you, and maybe this goes hand in hand with the last point, is to be a Christian and to go to heaven. You know, at some point, whether now or in the life to come, and I want you to think carefully about what I'm saying here. At some point, whether now or in the life to come, a person who really loves you and who you really love, that is what they will want from you more than anything else. Now, if I'm doing wrong, I may surround myself with other people who do wrong. I may run with them, as the phrase goes. They may be my buddies, my pals. They may be my friends. They may be my best friends. Because we share in those things we do wrong. That may be the case now. But if among that group, there's someone I really care about, I really love, and someone who really loves me, at some point, whether it's in this life later or it's in the life to come after we've all died, What they will want from me more than anything else is that I be a Christian. Let me suggest some passages and why I say this. I suggest this is a gift you can give to them, is to be a Christian and go to heaven. It's the greatest and most practical gift you can give to that person you love. You know, the Christian parent, maybe you're here today and you're not a Christian, but if you are and you have a Christian parent or a Christian child, a brother, a Christian friend, they want your faithfulness to the Lord more than any gift you could give them. You know, you think back to that funny story. Here were these boys, rich, prosperous, successful, giving to their mother very expensive gifts. I mean, how much is a new house? How much is a Mercedes SL600? I don't know, but I know they're expensive, you know. $100,000 theater built in the house. $100,000 parrot, you know, that was eaten like a chicken. But those gifts were expensive. And yet none of them were practical. None of them were what she needed or even wanted. As she wrote to her sons, you know, thank you anyway. It really doesn't mean any. And that's what she was really saying. Doesn't mean anything to me, but thank you anyway. Except for the parrot, she ate that. You know. But the most practical gift that you can give to the Christian friend, parent, child, is to be a Christian. That's really what they want. But let me suggest to you that the Bible teaches, you know, you might go to the parent that's a Christian or the friend or the brother that's a Christian. You might say, I love you. Sometimes those words are empty. The Bible teaches you in 1 John 3, I won't turn there and read it, but the Bible teaches us not just to love in word. The Bible teaches us to really love in what we do. Show our love. A Christian wants you to show your love to them by being faithful. That's really what they want from you. The Christian parent wants their Christian child to be a Christian. If you want to show you love me, be faithful to God. Because I care about you and I care for your soul and I care about the fact that if you're not faithful to God, you're going to be lost. And it hurts me every day, all day, if you're not a Christian. Be a Christian. Do what's right. Be faithful. You want to show you love me? Not just say you love me. But you want to show you love me? Be a Christian. The Bible teaches us that. We see it in so many passages. Again, in the book of Proverbs. I'd like for you to turn to Proverbs 23 and I want to read that. But we see passages like chapter 10 and verse 1 or 15 and 20 and others. A wise son makes for a glad father. You know, you see that phrase several times. Look with me at chapter 23 and drop down to verse 24. Notice what it says here. The father of the righteous shall greatly rejoice. You think about what it means to a Christian parent to have a child who's faithful to God. And how they think about that. How they're able every day when they think about that child, you know, a smile can come to the lips. Regardless of what's going on in life, they can think about it and rejoice in it. He that begets a wise child shall have joy of him. Your father and your mother shall be glad, and she that bare thee shall rejoice. The Bible is showing us here, and we know it's so, from a practical standpoint. You know that for your child to be a faithful Christian, if you are a Christian, you know that that means more to you than anything else in this world. It means more than how rich or successful they become, you know, how beautiful they are, you know, how many people in this world like them or anything else. It's just the most important thing to you. In Romans chapter 10, we see Paul, you know, and you think about how sad these passages are. Brethren, my heart's desire for Israel is that they be saved. In fact, in chapter 9, Paul goes so far as to say, I could wish myself accursed. And I don't really know that I understand all this. At times, I think for the people I love the most, that I come to somewhat understand it. But I could wish myself accursed from Christ so that my kinsmen, my family in the flesh could be saved. It's because you want it so bad. You want it so much. You want it more than anything. Perhaps even the salvation of your own soul. You want the person you love to go to heaven. You want to give something to somebody you love? Be a Christian. Go to heaven. In fact, let me suggest to you that even if they're unfaithful, the unfaithful family member or friend, the one that's not a Christian, will one day want that from you more than anything else. Now you might say, I don't believe that. No, think about what I'm saying. If you love somebody, you may not be a Christian right now, But you know you love your child. You know you love your brother. You know you love your friend. Okay, fine. Fair. I accept that. Let me suggest to you someone who was not a Christian, someone who was not faithful to God, someone who did not care about faithful things, that did exactly this. One day after this life was over, more than anything else, he wanted them to be saved. Turn in your Bibles, if you will, to Luke 16. And if you know the story there, and I'm not going to read it, but if you know the story there, Jesus told a story of a rich man and then also of a poor man named Lazarus, a beggar. They both died. They both went to Hades, where we go after we leave this life. And the Bible talks about Lazarus being comforted in Abraham's bosom, and everything was wonderful for him. And it talks about the rich man who lifted up his eyes being in torments. But the Bible goes on to show us that the rich man remembered those he loved. He thought about his family members. He thought about those that were still alive. Now, we don't think about this a lot. We don't think about people who have died being somewhere, and they're thinking about us back here. I mean, we think about them, but we don't so often picture them somewhere thinking about us and what they're thinking and what they're feeling. But Jesus gave us insight to what they're thinking and feeling. And he talked about this rich man. And the point is, no matter how they felt here, I mean, he was a rich guy. And he had everything he wanted, and that's the way he lived. He partied and so forth. He enjoyed his life. And he seemed to not care much for other people around him. He didn't care about Lazarus. He didn't reach out and help him and so forth. He just was an uncaring individual, the way a lot of people are, really. But the Bible shows us that they all want the same for us, and there's still two things we can do, even for people who have died. And I'll suggest those to you. One you find in Luke 16. Remember the point of the story? When it comes to the end there, after he said, "Send Lazarus to dip his finger in water and cool my tongue, I'm in these flames and it's tormenting me," and so forth, when he realized that that couldn't happen, and finally he said, "Well, Father Abraham, do this. Send somebody back to earth. Let somebody come back from the dead. Because I've got five brothers. And apparently the five brothers living just like him. I've got five brothers. And I want somebody to go back and tell them, teach them, show them that yes, you die. And when you die, you go to this horrible place. And you don't want to go there." Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." "No, Father Abraham." He pleaded with him. Why? Because people who have died, regardless of how they felt here, people who have died want one thing for you and one thing only. And the one thing they want for you is for you to be faithful and you to go to heaven. The second thing you can do to them might be suggested in passages like Proverbs 22 and verse 1. To be a Christian is to bring honor to the name you share. It's the idea of being almost a memorial to an individual. You know, here's the point. I'll make it very simply. If I've lost someone that wasn't a Christian, and I have. If I've lost someone who wasn't a Christian, there isn't anything I can do to save that person any longer. I can't teach them. I can't baptize them. I can't do anything so that their sins will be forgiven. And regardless of how much people want to believe in second chances and all of that kind of thing, the Bible never teaches it. But one thing I can do is I can realize that somewhere that person still loves me. The rich man loved his brothers. That person still loves me. And that person still wants me to be a Christian and to not come to that same place. I can bring honor to our name. I can bring honor in the sense of being faithful to God, being what I'm supposed to be. When people speak our family name, they'll think about the way I live my life. I can do that. It's a practical gift. It's a great gift to give. Jesus gave the greatest gift. James led some songs, and in particular, that idea of, "I've done this for you, what have you done for me?" Jesus gave the greatest gift to us long ago. He gave us living water, as he told the woman at the well. He gave us himself. And greater love has no man than this, to lay down his life for his friends. No greater love can be shown. No more practical gift can be given than to give yourself. Let me close by making this point. We'll ask the question, what's the greatest and most practical gift I can give? To many people, love is something you can buy. A house, a $100,000 theater, a car. It's something you can buy. And they spend a lifetime finding it's useless to try. May we learn for the time we have left, the greatest gift is the gift of self. Give yourself today. If you're here today and you're not a Christian, confess your belief in Jesus. Be willing to give yourself. Be a Christian. It's the greatest gift you can give yourself, but it's also the greatest gift you can give to all those around you. Be a Christian. Confess your belief in Jesus. Be willing to repent, to be baptized for forgiveness of your sins. If you've done that, and your life is not what it needs to be, make it different today. Confess your faults, ask for prayers, change your life, and leave this place today a faithful Christian. It'll be the best thing you can do for your children, for your parents, for your friends, and obviously for yourself.